Excellent. Well, thank you all for staying awake. And with the lights are down, I was kind of looking around a little earlier when the lights were down. Everyone is staying awake. Good job. So we're going to go now into day five and then into day six of creation. And some of the words, some of the terminology that you're probably catching already, some of the words are design, engineered, intelligence. Some of those type of things are come into play, that it's just the idea of this being a consequential cosmic accident is very difficult to intelligently take, intelligently accept. But we're going to go ahead and go to day five here. Is this sounding okay? Am I kind of echoing? Okay. All right, it just must be up here where I'm hearing it. So day five, that's going to be, we'll just talk here about the sea creatures and the birds, which were created on the fifth day of creation. And the Genesis 1, 20 through 23. Let me get my ear adjusted here a little bit. All righty. Then God said, "Let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens." So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded, according to their kind. There's that word kind again. That's going to be showing up for all the animals, and also going to be an important thing when the animals go on the ark. So that concept and idea about kind, we're going to come back to that again. So according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth." So the evening and the morning, the fifth day. On the birds, there's some amazing designs that take place with them. The pelican here, we'll look at the skeletal system of the bird and take that as a bird example and talk about how the skeletal system plays in with flight. How the amazing thing of flight occurs. And just watch this for a bit.
This is a remarkable balance that the bird has to maintain between structural strength of the bone and the needs for flight.
In order to fly, a bird must be strong enough to free its body from the bonds of gravity and light enough to remain suspended in the air. Its skeletal system is crucial to success. This adult pelican weighs more than 20 pounds and has the strength to fly hundreds of miles before landing. Yet its entire skeleton weighs less than 30 ounces. How? The majority of the bird's bones are hollow and reinforced by an internal network of girders and struts. The result is a light but durable framework, able to withstand the constant stress of flapping, takeoffs, and landings.
Feathers do a lot of different things really, really well, and they're very specialized in the way they're designed.
Birds are covered by several types of feathers. Closest to the skin, a soft, thick coat of down provides excellent insulation. And the down is encased by multiple layers of contour and primary feathers. These outer layers give a bird its streamlined shape, protection from moisture, and the ability to maneuver freely in the air. To do so, they must be light, strong, and extremely flexible. When a Canadian goose approaches a pond, the long primary feathers on its wingtips bend and twist open like a Venetian blind. Simultaneously, the alula, three feathers attached to a small bone, is raised to create a slot that alters the path of turbulent air rushing over the wing. The precise actions of these mechanisms prevent stalling while slowing the bird's descent for a controlled, soft landing.
You're going to need specialized muscles to move those wings. So your pectoral muscles in particular are going to be very large.
Hundreds of muscles, tendons, and ligaments power a diverse range of wing movements. The centerpieces of this system are the flight muscles. Pectoralis major, and beneath it, supracoracoideus. Together, they form the engines of avian flight. When the pectoral muscles contract, they pull the humerus bone in each wing down, creating thrust and lift. In immediate response, the supracoracoideus, connected by a tendon to the top of the humerus, works like a pulley to lift the wing every time the muscle contracts.
This is another terrific design because this pulley system eliminates the need for a large, heavy muscle above the shoulder to lift the wing back up. Instead, the flight muscles are all below the wings, where they help create a compact center of gravity that really stabilizes the bird's body in the air. Everything on a bird is integrated together so that flight is possible. Everything that possibly can be reduced in weight is reduced. Everything that can be moved towards the center of mass is moved. All of these engineering compromises, all of these refinements, it's multiple systems working together perfectly in a coordinated way all at once. And when you put that puzzle together, and the pieces fit in exactly the right way, then boom, you have the magic, and the birds can fly.
Humbly, we say, wow. Isn't that amazing? Next time you watch a bird in flight, maybe look at it a little bit differently and think, what an awesome God that made a bird that way to be able to fly and also to glorify himself and for us to enjoy. Just going to give another example here, the Arctic tern, amazing bird, migrates successfully to and from their starting point, 50,000 miles a year. Only bird that can hover aerodynamically other than hummingbirds. Travels an estimated 1.5 million miles over their lifetime, or three trips to the moon. So that's an amazing Arctic tern. Another type of a bird is the penguin. The penguins are going to be a flightless bird, but they are not one which is without its unique and amazing features. Each penguin has a distinct call which allows them to find young among thousands that are gathered. Fluff feathers while swimming to release bubbles, which reduces water viscosity and increases the speed. They can dive over 1,850 feet deep, enabled by their solid bone design, to to avoid the barotrauma, and a slowed heart rate to 15 beats per minute, shutting down non-essential organs up to 22 minutes underwater. Another wow, another amazing thing. More about bird designs. I'll probably skip this video here, but it's, you probably most have seen the starlings that in flight, all the blackbirds, you see them over the horizon, just these waves of these blackbirds flying together. And there's nothing that the Blue Angels or any of the formed tactical flight jets can't even compare to what those birds are doing, how they're all in a flock and flying together and not crashing and tumbling out and everything to that effect. I bet living here in the great area of Emporia, you've probably witnessed, just a kind of a cloud of blackbirds over in the sky. Just, next time you see that, just take time to watch them and enjoy. God did that for you. I'm going to go ahead and skip that so we can go on here to day six. But that is day five, where the sea creatures and the birds, flying creatures, were created by God. And I'm going to then, on day six, I'm going to talk about the animals that were developed on the land. And then at the end of that, then, of course, we know that humans, man, was made also on day six. Then Michael will take over and talk about that. But in Genesis 1, 25 to 20, 24 to 25, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth, each according to its kind." And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to his kind, cattle according to his kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to his kind. And God saw that it was good. So God then created all the other creatures and animals at this time to be on the earth. When it says creeping, the creeping things, that is going to include the reptiles, the amphibians, probably also going to include maybe the insects. But there's different thoughts on that. Some think the insects might have needed to have been created when the plants were created, because the insects do pollination and help the plants then to reproduce and make their seeds. However, if it was just another 48 hours later, we might have been okay here to wait until the insects were developed on day six. So sometimes that question comes up about when were the insects created. But the land animals, some of the amazing creatures, of course, we have the biggest one living now is the elephant. The elephant design. The brain of design with cognitive mapping to remember large scale spaces over long periods of time. They can hear one another trumpeting for up to 6 miles. Sensory cells in the feet enable detection of ground vibrations that travel up its leg and shoulder bones into its middle ear. The multi-purpose trunk, used uniquely for everything from communicating to eating, has more than 40,000 muscles in that trunk. I know that's kind of small. You might not be able to see it back there in the background, but that is just to give you an idea about how amazing the elephant is. And what we see with the elephant is probably paled by the dinosaurs that used to live on the earth as well, which would be, which could have gotten huge before they were wiped out with the flood. So we're going to go on to another amazing creature that was designed. And we probably picked the elephant and cheetah and another one here. Not going to be quite as common around Emporia, Kansas, such as cattle, horses, sheep, and goats. But just give you an idea is that what amazing, unique features these animals have. The cheetah has unique muscle and skeletal structure, enables acceleration from 0 to 60 miles per hour in 3 seconds. You could probably take on the Tesla. Design of the tail facilitates high-speed steering like a modern boat rudder. Complex vessels in the inner ear enable balance, leverage to turn in mid-air while sprinting over 70 miles an hour. I used to teach a veterinary technician school, and probably one of the most fascinating papers which was given back to me was about the cheetah and its locomotion mechanics and everything with that. So that been a favorite animal of mine as well. Let's go on to a giraffe. God's complex systems in the animals, with the giraffe there. Those animals, the males, can be up to 4,000 pounds, 18 feet tall, and we have a little video here. We'll watch here just a little bit about it. But if there's any details they forgot, I'll fill that in. So.
What stands up to 19 feet tall, weighs 3,000 pounds, has gangly legs, and an 18-inch long tongue? There's only one animal living today that fits that bill, and that's the stately giraffe. One of the really neat things about the giraffe's neck is that when it leans down to take a drink of water, you would think that all the blood would run to its head. They would pass out, you would say. But they have a 25-pound heart with over twice the blood pressure of humans. But they don't pass out or receive too much blood pressure. You see, the giraffe's neck has reinforced blood vessels and valves that restrict the blood flow when their heads are down. Have you ever gotten dizzy when you stood up too quickly? So why don't giraffes get dizzy and fall over when they lift their heads quickly up to 19 feet? Well, it seems that they have something similar to a sponge in their heads that releases just the right amount of blood to the brain until their blood pressure equalizes. Pretty amazing. Now let's talk about the legs. When walking, giraffes alternatively move both right legs and then both left legs. When running, their back legs reach past the front legs before they move forward, and they kick those powerful legs when fighting off predators so successfully that they can fight off pretty much anything except lions. They can live up to 25 years in the wild. We've talked about the control of blood pressure in the giraffe's head, but why doesn't blood pool in their legs? Well, it seems that the special strong and tight skin in their legs prevents that. How special is it? Scientists have studied the skin of the giraffe's legs when designing flight suits for fighter pilots and astronauts. Just like me, people have been fascinated with giraffes for thousands of years. Did you know the Egyptians actually kept them as pets and they gave them their own hieroglyph? Now, throughout Africa, they're depicted in art, including petroglyphs, pictures carved into rocks. The same is true for Greece and in Rome. Now, how could anyone overlook the stately giraffe? Amazing creatures with unique features that can teach us a lot about life itself. The biblical book of Genesis, which seems to be written as a historical narrative, mentions a creator who made all plants and animals and also created mankind with the ability to appreciate, study, and help and protect and conserve the things that we find in nature.
Before we go to the different systems of that we see in the mammals and all that. An interesting thing about the giraffe is that one of their favorite foods is leaves from the acacia tree. This is just one little branch from acacia tree. And the thorns here are pretty amazing, but it's they said that the tongue was about 20 inches long, And so the tongue is able to, you know, reach in and around and strip the leaves off of this thorny branch of a acacia tree. And if you ever, you know, maybe you've probably already been there, but the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo in Colorado Springs, you can go and feed the giraffes there. So you're up on a platform there, they're sticking their heads up and over, and their 20-inch tongue is reaching down and grabbing this this lettuce, in which you paid like $10 a leaf for to be able to feed the giraffes. But it's worth it. It's a great memory. And so, okay, the other thing is that to talk about with all these creatures and also with us, just real briefly, there are systems within each of them as well. As you all know, you know, they're not all of them are listed up there, but you have the pulmonary system, the lungs. Over here is going to be depicting the muscle-skeletal system, the muscles and the bones, how those all work together for locomotion. This over here is going to be an indication of a neurological system. It's going to be everything from the brain to the nerves and senses. Then you have the digestive system. Here is showing the cow with the four stomachs. So there's the different creatures are going to have different numbers of stomachs, and as many of you already know. Then there's the cat here depicting the lymphatic system, and that's the helps with controlling infections and things along those lines. Over here is going to be a red blood cell, and then the and a blood vessel, and which is going to be consistent with the circulatory system, cardiovascular system. Besides this, we have the endocrine system, which is hormonal system, and then the urogenital system as well, the urinary tract, and then the reproductive tract. So all those systems in our bodies are working together at once to form a consistent balance within our bodies, a balance of physiology. A simple thing is the balance of what our temperatures are at normal. All those are working together and communicating. Just when we get to that level, it just becomes, just an amazing, fascinating thing in which the statement is that our bodies are fearfully and wonderfully made has a whole lot more impact. On day six, there's also dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were living with the other animals and also with man at the same time on the earth would be consistent with our thinking with the creation and the land animals and everything as well. In Job 40, 15 through 18, behold, now behemoth which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold, now his strength is in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron, and he is the first of the ways of God. Some tried to describe that as a elephant or hippopotamus, if you see some old notes in Bibles, but dinosaurs, yes, they were they fit in the Bible. They fit there just with man as well, and there's other
evolution holds that dinosaurs evolved 220.
For sake of time, we're not going to do that video as well. Thanks for doing the lights, but we aren't going to do that video. But we are going to point out that art sculptures that were done by man depicting the figures that look like dinosaurs, those are ancient sculptures, ancient things of which have occurred. And this is one over here, is a tile work. Here's a hunting scene. This is to show huge brontosaurs, which have the long neck, you know, up and around in here. So that is indicative that in order for that artist to have made that particular piece of artwork must have been familiar with that creature that they have seen in nature. So now we're at mankind, and sorry for I have to go through that relatively quickly, but we want to make sure we get everything covered here for you all tonight. All right, thank you all for listening.
This is an image that looks a lot like a stegosaurus, and this was obviously found in an area where I want to say the Mayans or someone like that, the civilization, and before stegosaurus were even dug up as real dinosaurs, and so we have this situation where we use the word design all the time, that animals appear to have been designed because they are designed. That's what the scriptures say, that instead of life starting in the ocean and slowly climbing onto land and diversifying and becoming, lizards and amphibians and things on land and then eventually into birds, that and then eventually into people and every other animal that we see around us, that continuous transformation is what evolution says. But the scriptures are completely different. They talk about this was a day and this was when God created this group that has a genetic boundary that has life and reproduced after its kind. And so humans are no different in that we are a special creation of God. God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was now very good. So that was evening and morning, the sixth day. And so people are a unique creation of God that occurred on day six, this part of day six. And people and the world and living things and the universe don't come with a user's manual or a how it was made manual. The Bible's the closest thing we get to that. So we have to use science and analysis to figure out how living things work, and that's what we've done over centuries. And this is the human body, about 60% water, 16% protein, and these are, it's hard to see these things, 6% minerals, 1% carbohydrate, 16% fat, although some of us have a little more percentage than others. And then these are just simply elements: oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, calcium, phosphorus, et cetera. And the end result is just simply to say that we're made of dirt. This is the composition of dirt. If you analyze dirt, and that's what we're made out. We're made out of the dust of the earth that God formed and breathed into the breath of life, and man became a living soul, a being. There may have been a physical body that God enlivened with a spirit, and that is called soul, a nephesh. But we're just dirt. And when we die, we go back to dirt. And our elements are recycled, but who we are continues. Our soul, our spirit continues, even though we may be separated from a body, and we believe that God will give us a new body at the appropriate time, and we'll see our loved ones again and those sorts of things. But people who are naturalists and, you know, some of these atheists, they have no hope because they know they're going to die and just go back to dirt. And so what's the purpose of life? Because after your whole life of working, somebody else inherits what you've created, or the great kingdoms that you've conquered, if you're, you know, Peter the Great or various conquerors, somebody else inherits them. The great dynasties of Egypt, you know, they passed along the great inheritance because each one of them died. And we will all face that. But life is a very complex thing. It's not the same thing as a complex piece of equipment. And I'll say something about that in a little while. But I want you to watch through this video as we think about life is based on information. And that information is in every one of our cells in our DNA, which we can't see, but is there. And if you take the DNA out of a single cell and hook it all together, it's about a meter long. It's 3 billion base pairs long. That's how it's encoded. The information chemically rides on the chemicals of the DNA molecule, which in our cells are in chromosomes, are in different pieces of DNA, which when they condense down are into 23 pairs of homologous chromosomes. And just think about that. Life is more than simply something that is complex, because the space shuttle was complex, but it's not alive.
Just as English letters convey a particular message depending on their arrangement, the sequences of chemical bases along the spine of the DNA molecule convey precise instructions for building proteins. The arrangement of these bases directs the arrangement of the 20 different kinds of amino acids that make up protein molecules. Proteins, in turn, perform a vast array of critical jobs inside cells, catalyzing reactions, processing genetic information, and forming the structural parts of molecular machines and other biological structures. Building new animals requires many new protein molecules, and building new proteins requires new biological information.
I used to ask my students a question when I was teaching. If you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And they would know. They would say code or software or instructions, a program. All those are the correct answer. To generate a new function in a computer, you have to have code. You have to have instructions. The same thing turns out to be true in biology. This is the great discovery of the second half of 20th century biology, that information is running the show in biological systems. To build a new form of animal life requires cell types, requires proteins, and therefore requires genetic information. And that's the big question that the Cambrian explosion presents. If you want to think about how to build an animal, how would these animals get built, you have to have some explanation for the informational requirements of their construction.
According to modern evolutionary theory, new proteins and new forms of animal life arise through random genetic mutations sifted by natural selection. But in an alphabetic text or a section of computer code, random changes typically degrade meaning or functionality and ultimately generate gibberish.
As we've come to appreciate the digital or typographic character of genetic information, it raises some really interesting questions about the efficacy of that mutation-driven mechanism. And we know from computer code, for example, that if you start making random changes to a section of computer code, you're much more likely to degrade the information that's there already than you are to come up with a new operating system or program.
This problem has long been recognized by computer scientists, mathematicians, and engineers, including a group from MIT who convened a now famous conference at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia in 1966. These scientists met to consider whether the random mutation natural selection mechanism could conceivably generate enough biological information to build a new animal or even a new protein in the time available to the evolutionary process. One of these scientists was MIT engineering professor Murray Eden.
No currently existing formal language can tolerate random changes in the symbol sequences which express its sentences. Meaning is almost invariably destroyed. Murray Eden, MIT.
Eden knew that random changes to alphabetic or digital characters inevitably degrade the information in any section of alphabetic text or digital code, and for a very good reason.
Whether you're talking about digital code in a software program or a section of text in an English sentence or book or the genetic text in DNA, there are vastly more ways to arrange the relevant characters that convey the information in a way that will produce gibberish than there are that will produce function or meaning.
Eden and his colleagues suspected that the genetic code faced a similar difficulty. When it came to producing new genetic information, at least enough to generate a new protein, the random mutation natural selection mechanism had to deal with what mathematicians call a combinatorial problem.
All right, we're gonna pause this because we're running out of time, but when we talk about animals, when we talk about people, animals can live and people can live because physiology has solved the problems of living. A bird can fly because it has minimal weight and has a greater strength to weight ratio, and it has wings that are designed in a certain way and a center of gravity that's a certain way, you saw elephants can migrate hundreds of miles because their brain can remember the way. And cheetah can run 70 miles an hour, and they can run from a standing start 100 meters in 3.5 seconds. You know, even Usain Bolt can't do that. And they are faster than the animals that they want to eat, and so they can survive. And life is a problem for any kind of an organism, animals and people. And we have to solve the problems of living. And that's where information comes from. All of the animals that are alive have solved all the problems of living, how to stay warm, how to move, how to reproduce, how to compete, how to live, etc. And human beings have various similarities to many, many animals, but we're not animals. We are a unique creation of God, because you can't sit down with a chimpanzee and have a conversation. And chimpanzees don't write music or books. And yet the people who believe in evolution believe that the chemical properties of the paper and the ink in a book wrote the content of the book. That's what evolution is saying. Evolution is saying that random chance of these characters in a book changes, created the information, and it's based on the properties of the ink and the paper. Well, we all know that books have authors, and that's who God is. God is the author of the information of life. And a good analogy is simply an airplane. An airplane is composed of non-flying parts, but it flies, right? The wing by itself doesn't fly. The wheels by themselves don't fly. The door by itself doesn't fly. But when all of those parts are integrated, these 6 million parts of a 747 are integrated and fueled and controlled by some intelligent control system, or intelligently made control system if it's on autopilot, then the result is flight. It's something totally different than the component parts. And that's what life is. Life is not the dirt that we're made up of. Life is different, wholly different than the parts. The sum of the parts is vastly different. Just like flight is a characteristic of non-flying parts when they are integrated into a whole by intelligent designers and engineers who can construct something like that. And so we have this video about the ear. We're all using hearing, how it can use pressure waves in the air to move little bones within the ear that move a little in and out, a little hammer thing that moves, that creates liquid pressure waves in the inner ear that go into the cochlea that help transmit through movement of these little hairs in the cochlea, change that physical movement into an electrical signal that goes through a nerve to your brain that interprets what those changes are as sound. It's an amazing process. And it's a completely functional design where you got to have all the parts or it doesn't work. And that's called irreducible complexity, right? It's a complex thing, but you have to have all of the parts or you're deaf, or you're blind, or you can't walk, or something happens and you die. But God has made these structures fully and completely functional for us. And it's all based on the DNA information and the code. The fact that there is a 4-base code in the DNA is the same thing as, you know, a language that's based on 4 letters. Ours is based on, 26 letters in our alphabet. But it is very much a language, a genetic language, that creates a polar bear. And the genetic language that creates a polar bear is different than the language that creates a black bear or a brown bear, right? Or a fish. Or that's different than a shark. Where does that information come from? As far as we know, that kind of information only comes from intelligence, from an agreement between intelligence as to what the letters mean. So, ich kann mit dir sprechen auf Deutsch, ja? Und, you know, wir hören nun diese großen Leute hier. And it's good, so, yeah? And so I can speak to you in German, but unless you understand the convention of what those words and sentences mean in German, it doesn't mean anything to you. But if you're German or if you've learned German, you're now an intelligent person who has an agreement with me on what those words mean. Just like English, we're agreeing on what our words mean. That agreement between intelligences is where information comes from. It doesn't come from time, chance, natural selection. And we're gonna skip.
DNA is a good place.
You know, DNA is a wonderful thing, but it also is a tremendous storage of information. It has, you know, in a tablespoon of DNA, that's equal to 17 grams, it has 455 exabytes of data. You know, 7,900 exabytes of data in the collective history of the world would have to be contained in 400 million data servers. And you can put that, you know, in a teaspoon of DNA. You can store that much information. The scale of miniaturization that DNA represents, of encoding information into a single cell that can become 100 trillion cells in your body, is unbelievable. And we're just going to leave you tonight with the sayings of this great atheist, Richard Dawkins, and how his thoughts about DNA.
In biology, I suppose it would have to be the double helix, the Watson and Crick discovery of the structure of DNA, which was far more than just the discovery, the crystallographic work, discovering the structure of a big molecule. Because what that led up to was a major revolution in which much of biology became a sort of branch of information technology. The consequence of the Watson-Crick discovery, with all that it led on to, the DNA code and the sort of various genome projects that are going on now, is that genes, which from my point of view are absolutely central to biology, genes are information. They are coded information It even looks like computer information. I mean, a chromosome is a great long computer tape. It's linear, runs one-dimensional, digital code. It's not binary, it's quaternary, but apart from that, it's just the same as computer tape. It's read in sequence. It's copied and pasted from one part of the organism to another in just the same way as a computer programmer would copy and paste.
Okay, so, but yet it made itself. Yet all that information came from random chance. We don't think so. And that's what this class is about, recognizing that that information comes from the mind of God.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for being patient. It's 9:04. We're close. In the morning, would you go up one more slide, Michael, if you could? Tomorrow's a depressing day. This was exciting. God's creation is amazing. And no, that's not what I wanted, but that's okay. We're going to talk about three judgments tomorrow. It'll be the fall with Adam and Eve. Then we're going to have the flood, another judgment. And then we're going to talk about the tower, a third judgment.